You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Glad you're listening this morning. I wouldn't want you to miss this conversation. Some memoirs build to a slow burn with astute observations and quiet revelations. Dr. Michelle Harper's memoir punches you in the gut on the second page, describing what it means to witness day after day that ephemeral border between life and death. She writes, "I am the doctor whose palms bolster the head of the 20-year-old man with a gunshot wound to his brain. I support the baby as she takes her first breath outside her mother's womb. I hug the wife whose husband is dying from advanced liver disease as she implores the universe to take away his pain." This is a memoir about medicine and vulnerability and redemption and loss and love. And as Dr. Harper joins us, it occurred to me that there may be some among us, I'm included here, who have had some exceptionally meaningful interaction as a patient, as a loved one, with a doctor or nurse. Someone who guided us through the death of a loved one, listened to our pain with kindness and empathy. And if you've had an experience like that, I think this would be a good hour to share that. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. Again, if you've had an experience with a loved one who is going through an especially difficult time, maybe you were the patient, and a doctor or a nurse or another medical professional stepped in with receptive listening and a lot of empathy and a lot of kindness, and it made all the difference. I'd love to hear your experience with that. And I think Dr. Harper would too. 651-227-6000. Of course, you can reach me on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Dr. Michelle Harper is an emergency room physician, the author of The Beauty in Breaking, and she joins us today from Philadelphia. Dr. Harper, we're going to be talking about some pretty personal things. Would you mind if I call you Michelle from here on in?
Sure. No problem
okay.
at all.
It's really nice to have you on the show. I really find your capacity for stillness and attention in the ER quite extraordinary. I think of the ER as a place of swirling chaos much of the time, but you really have this ability to center yourself and look and listen. So how'd you develop those skills?
Yeah, and you're right. And much of the time it's like that. Sometimes it's not. But I feel that that's a skill that I learned when I was younger. Growing up in an abusive home where there, at any moment, there could be an eruption of violence. It was so unsettling at all times. And I had to learn at that point, even young, before I had the language to express myself, before I had the ability to fully comprehend it. But to learn how to be still. I mean, in some ways, I feel like I was groomed to go into emergency medicine because all you have is a snapshot in time where you have to decide, okay, is this immediately life-threatening? Is it likely to blow over? What can I do right now? Mm-hmm. So those were the circumstances that got me here.
I mean, you describe this is a situation in a home where your father could erupt with fury and violence at any moment. You describe this kind of constant vigilance. Mm-hmm. You know, while that's an extremely valuable, necessary skill sometimes, it's also really emotionally exhausting, isn't it?
So depleting. And it was important at the time. You know, just an example where it could have been any day, but one day where my brother was trying to protect my mother and restrained my father. And my father bit my brother on the hand, causing such a significant injury that needed medical attention. And I remember feeling in that moment, you know, if this man could do this to a family member, if this act of brutality, none of us were safe. It was completely unpredictable. And because of moments like that, I just had to cultivate some sense of hope. I felt that there was another way. I remember going to the ER where I saw all manner of life gathering there, whether it was a little girl with a cut or a homeless man just needing refuge for a moment from the elements. But there were places where people could find hope and healing, and that stayed with me. And so I figured, you know, when I grow up, I must survive this. I must survive this for my family and do what I can to help them and then be a support system for others in their healing journeys. And so that while my experiences definitely were depleting, the idea of it the capacity for it being different was restorative.
Let me take a call here for you from Jamie in Duluth. Hi, Jamie. I'm so glad you called.
Hey, Carrie. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, for sure.
Hey, so I've worked in the healthcare field for a few years now, and I'm hoping to go to medical school one day. Mm-hmm. I currently work as an EMT at the jail up here in Duluth, and I've worked in a trauma center as a scribe, and I've worked in a variety of roles. And the doctors that do what we're talking about, where they're empathetically listening, giving of themselves, it's amazing. But I have witnessed a culture of burnout while I've been in the hospital, of folks who seem like maybe over the years they can't give so much emotionally. And I guess I'm curious what advice you'd give to up-and-coming providers who are inspired and want to keep doing what you're talking about, and how to, I guess, navigate this other culture that, you know, is rifled with being overworked or, you know, not being protected by your administration or just by getting burnt out by everything you're seeing?
That's a terrific question and really timely. Dr. Harper, what would you say?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of burnout and there's increasing burnout. And I think the approach to this will be, there'll be a couple layers. I mean, of course, there's the self-care, healthy eating, meditation, whatever helps you personally, spiritually, emotionally, physically. And then there's also the question of why one is going into medicine, because I will have to say, and I often get this question from women, people of color, just anybody who cares, that I don't feel that love of the field will be enough. I feel that it's going to have to be a mission. And if this is your mission in life, if this is part of your calling, that will be enough to keep you there and keep you centered there. And then the other level that's also critical is the work to change the field. And because there is increasing bureaucracy, there are many aspects of medicine that will keep us from doing the work we're there to do. And that's where each of us needs to become an advocate to improve the field.
Michelle, if you're missing the calling part of it, why is just love of the field not enough?
Because honestly, I think like anything else, it's going to break you. I mean, I remember hearing an interview with Liz Gilbert that says, I'm not going to use profanity, but that every field has like a poo sandwich along with it. There's difficulties with it. And if you love it enough, you'll eat that sandwich every day. It's enough to keep you there. So in medicine, for example, your very astute caller mentioned it, and COVID is laying this bare, one of the many things COVID is laying bare, lack of protective equipment, for example, lack of the resources we need to do our job, not being backed up by administration, the pay cuts, the furloughs, being understaffed. These things are happening in medicine because it's part of an American society where healthcare is more seen as a privilege that makes profits than a right to secure health and wellness for the people in this nation. So until it's seen as a right to secure health and wellness for the people of this nation, it's not going to be run appropriately. So it's up to each of us, those in the field and outside of it, to demand better. So if it's a calling, you'll stay and embrace this work. Mm-hmm. But if it's not, it becomes untenable.
Jen says on Twitter, Nurse Joanne at St. Luke's in Duluth gave us the straight story about my dad. While his team of doctors were doing patient-centered care, i.e., not telling him he was dying, to the phones to Cynthia in Minneapolis. Cynthia, I'm really glad you called. What's your experience with this?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate this discussion.
Good.
My father died at 90 3 years ago, and he was very healthy and completely competent, smart guy. He had a brief diagnosis of tongue cancer, and he was in an Eau Claire hospital and got very, very good care. But he also, because he was so healthy, was encouraged to pursue aggressive treatment for this cancer that would not have been successful, and he would have suffered greatly. And his wife, unfortunately, was also pushing for this. And I was standing by watching this with my siblings, and a nurse saw our own heartache around this and our inability to directly deal with this. And she was amazing. She found private time with my father, with the doors closed, without his spouse. And she told him that he could choose. He could choose to say no to treatment. He could also choose to say yes, but that he had the choice to do that, and that it was his choice and no one else's. And I will forever remain so grateful to her because she gave him such dignity. And he died 4 weeks later by stopping feeding tube treatments in his feeding tube at home in hospice. And
Cynthia, the way you think your dad absolutely wanted it. Is that right?
I think he needed someone to help him understand that it was
right.
His choice. Excuse me. And yes, and ultimately he wanted it. He did not want to be, he was a terrible patient. He did not want to go through more medical intervention. And I can't even remember the nurse's name, which I feel bad about. And I've wanted to thank her for 3 years.
I think we have the core of what you were going to say. Dr. Harper, those have got to be the most difficult situations you find yourself in.
They are difficult, and I want to just amplify that point that taking the time to communicate, you know, when one has the time, when one is able to, taking the time to communicate and giving, often we need permission. Interestingly enough, we need permission to make our own decisions because she's right. There's so much family pressure. There can be pressure from other healthcare providers, but hopefully there is someone there on the team who will give full information and say, you know, this is your right to decide, and I'm going to support you in that.
We're having a conversation, if you've just tuned in, with Dr. Michelle Harper about her new memoir. I've recommended it to a lot of people. I hope you'll read it. It's called The Beauty in Breaking. She spent a lot of time as an ER physician, and her experience in medicine is informed by growing up in a home with childhood abuse and violence. If you caught the beginning of the show, we talked about how Dr. Harper cultivated this ability to be still and pay attention. Some of that comes out of her experience as growing up in a violent home. She writes a lot in the memoir about different experiences with different patients and how meaningful they've been and how much they've taught her about what it means to be an empathetic listener, somebody who can bring candor and attention to the experience when there's a lot of things swirling around her. And it made me think that many of us, I think, have had experiences with medical professionals that just turned a very difficult situation into something manageable because they stepped in. I've had this experience. So if you'd like to share something like that, I think that would help inform the conversation this morning. 651-227-6000. Maybe you had this experience as a patient, maybe as the loved one of a patient. someone who guided us through the death of a loved one, someone who listened to pain with kindness and empathy. It's what you want. 800-242-2828 on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. Dr. Harper, will you tell us the story of baby Jenny, who shows up in the ER with liver damage? And I have to say, you know, this is one of those experiences that I think, you know, a doctor might say, so I've seen what this can be. This is that calling in the mission thing, right, that you talked about earlier. Tell us a little bit about what happened.
So, young child, almost two, brought in unresponsive, a doting father, and it seemed that she had a febrile seizure. Generally not a big deal. Little kid has a fever. They have a seizure and usually go on to have a perfectly fine life. Sometimes it's a little more complicated. They don't wake up right away, and that was the situation. So we're evaluating her to make sure there's no infection or anything else going on that we can reverse. Looking at her, she's beautiful. She's perfect. Physical exam, totally normal. I click off the requisite test, order an extra test of liver function. I didn't really need, but I couldn't bring myself to not check it, so fine. We get ready to transfer her because we don't admit pediatrics at that particular hospital where I was working at. She's, so far, everything looks good. Results are coming back. She's leaving out the door, packaged with EMS to go. And I get a call from the radiologist that it doesn't look like there's any infection on x-ray, but there are some broken bones, different phases of healing, probably none new today. And as I'm talking to her, the results are coming back and the liver function tests are really abnormal. And it occurs to me that this little girl probably isn't waking up because she's been beaten. And I look back and she's still so like quiet and still in the stretcher, and the father's weeping, more family shows up. They all seem appropriate, their behavior. I call the receiving hospital, tell them my concerns, that please work her up for trauma. I'm concerned that this isn't a febrile seizure at all, but she's been beaten, and that's why she's stuporous. And it turns out, I did get follow-up on that case, but that is what happened, that she was beaten badly, and she had bleeding in the liver and bruising of her brain, which is why she wasn't waking up that day.
I mean, so I think an important element of this is something that you said as you began to tell that story, which was doting father. I mean, that was confusing, and it kind of diverted you initially, right? You had to check your initial assumptions, it sounds like.
Yeah, and it's one of those situations where, you know, in my gut, I was concerned about this child. So I added some studies that I didn't need, but I just, my gut said move forward anyway. And I feel like there are times in stillness where we get information. We talked about stillness before, and that was important information in this case. I mean, by the same token, I try not to be moved by stereotypes and what's the profile of a batterer. It's hard to say. But you're right, it was confusing. It turns out he was the person who beat this child, but we still got the information we needed to care for this little girl. And if I feel it, if we're still, if we listen, we can hear these messages. We can hear the information we need from each other.
I want to point our... Because the way you grew up is so important to the way you're speaking now and to the way you practice medicine, that I want to mention that you write about what it meant to be in a household where you can hear the violence, but you can't see it. And you say, honestly, I don't know what's worse, constructing an image of brutality in your mind's eye or actually bearing witness to it. At seven, I didn't have the power to choose. And I thought as you described everything that went through your mind as it dawned on you that this baby had been abused, that in some ways you were calling on what you described there, that terrible experience, weren't you? You couldn't see this, but you could sure imagine the way it had unfolded.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And I do call upon that. My experience, you know, I try not to bring too much of my own experience and bias myself, but I do call upon that as I'm working. It brings a certain sensitivity for sure.
Let me take a call here from Holly in Minneapolis. Hi, Holly.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call and having this conversation.
Good.
I think it's really important that we talk about trauma and how it relates to the medical field.
For sure.
I personally grew up in a household of violence that was very traumatic growing up, but it has inspired me and woke me to a point where I studied and dedicated my life to sociology and how it affects violence in society. And I currently work at an organization in Minnesota that works with domestic violence victims and victims of trafficking, and we also work with youth who have been victims of, you know, household abuse. And you said something earlier that really just, like, resonated with me so much about having your career, like, you need more than just a passion for it. You need a mission. And that's how much, and I get asked this question all the time from family and friends, like, how do you deal with that? How do you go in, day out, and hear people's stories and not let it affect you? And, you know, my biggest, you know, personally, it was just, you know, I'm not doing this for individual, you know, I'm doing this for individual victims, but I'm doing this for, like, a broader scale of, you know, showing society of how domestic violence impacts families and making it a mission to show to people that if you're experiencing it, it's okay to seek help and there's no shame in it. So I'll take my call off the line, but
good.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, Holly, I'm glad you heard the show. Yeah. I mean, what she said about shame, Dr. Harper, is a pretty big element of this, isn't it?
Oh, it is huge. And I can say, well, of course, growing up, but even now as an adult, I mean, a lot of risk with writing a memoir and a memoir that speaks about family violence in the home. There's backlash from certain family members. It's triggering if you haven't processed it. And that's a big reason why it was important for me to write this book, to be part of removing that stigma. Because, you know, as I say in the book, it's only in silence that horror can persist. We need to be talking about this. We need to be screening for it. I'm reminded of when I was a child. Now that I'm an adult and physician and mandated reporter, I screen for all kinds of violence, like your caller said, whether it's trafficking or intimate partner violence or child abuse. I screen for that. It's important for me to do that. When I was young, no one ever asked me. So that's part of my mission now, and that's why I feel it's important to speak about it, no matter the risk involved for me personally.
I don't want to miss what you just said. No one in your, in your family circle, in the teachers that you were interacting, no one spotted what was going on
No. And I, you know, as I was writing this book, so much came back to me, and it seemed commonplace when I was young because it was this cult of silence. And now when I reflect upon it as an adult, my jaw almost drops that no teacher,
I know,
no doctor, no, like, extended family ever asked the question. And which is very common. I know that, but it's still heartbreaking.
Do you have some ideas as to why?
You know, there's so many articles about this, like, you know, opening Pandora's box. What do you do as a human if you ask a question and the answer is something that it reveals a problem that you feel you can't fix, and then feeling that, well, then I'll just leave it alone. You know, we'll both go along and agree to this silence because it seems easier. And then, of course, you know, structural misogyny and
right.
structural racism. I mean, there's all those factors as well. But again, part of, you know, why your last caller does this work and I do this work is to change all that.
Dr. Michelle Harper is with us. We're talking about her new memoir, The Beauty in Breaking. Katie says on Twitter, I recently lost my baby due to severe preeclampsia. I was cared for at Mother Baby Center in Minneapolis. We were devastated, but the nurse and doctors showed so much empathy. It allowed us to start healing. They even sent a card after we were home. They were phenomenal. And that's what we're doing as Dr. Harper's story unfolds here on the air and in her memoir. I've also been thinking about these interactions that we've had with doctors and nurses who just stepped up, right, with empathy and what I think of as receptive listening and how meaningful that is in the moment. And a number of you want to share those experiences. We'll get to more of that. I want to go to the phones to Paul in Grand Rapids. Paul, thanks so much for waiting through the newscast there. I'm glad you did.
Oh, thank you very much. Nice talking to you all. And I was just listening this morning, and I thought I just had to share.
Good.
I had, you know, last February, I was diagnosed with cancer, and the care that I was under was just phenomenal by specifically two doctors. But what made me think so much about this conversation now was I could not imagine the doctor having to make, I went in for just a general physical,
mm-hmm.
and within 2 hours, I'm sitting in a coffee shop after the physical thinking everything was okay, but the doctor called me back because he had gotten some test results back with some really high numbers, and he didn't even hesitate to say, well, we'll have to see what the rest of the results look like. He just said, you have cancer. And he was very confident of that. And they were so aggressive with treating me. The next day they had me visiting a urologist. And I sit back today and think, what a difficult phone call that must have been for him.
Right.
To say, hey, you know, I'm here for you. But yet also how aggressively they handled it. And the next day, the urologist who met with me, you know, he cried with me. And I knew I was in the right place when I had a doctor that hugged me and cried with me, and my wife, for that matter. And so I just knew I was going to be okay. I understood a whole new understanding of empathy and love from other individuals who didn't know me, you know, 3 days ago. So,
Paul, you bring up something I did want to get to with Dr. Harper, which is, so what are you told in medical school about how openly emotional you can and should be?
Yeah. Well, and first, Paul, thank you for sharing. And I'm so glad you got good care. And I hope you're healing well from everything you've been through. What are we told in medical school? Not much. And medical education, it's changing. You know, like there are humanities and medical education courses now, or at least lecture series on it. But yes, not much. And generally, the message is to keep it professional and to keep a professional distance at all times. That's pretty much how it goes, and then each provider has to figure it out for themselves as they go along.
That's I think that is why patients tell some of the stories that Paul just did, and others say,
right.
I had a pretty negative experience
right.
when I was at, the family was in, you know, an extreme situation, and the doctors and nurses just seem disengaged, right? That's why you don't get that kind of training in med school. I don't know why. Do you?
It's true. It's true. And even worse than that, in clinical situations, whether it's the ER or, you know, I feel awful for primary care providers. Even there's so much pressure. You move people in and out.
Yeah.
You're penalized if you don't. So taking that extra, even 15 minutes, is an eternity, and it's discouraged. So it's challenging to be decent.
I want to talk about Victoria Honor. You encountered her at the VA. It's a wonderful chapter, wonderful experience. Tell us a little bit about how you two kind of moved into this much deeper relationship that short-lived, but that has really been meaningful for you.
It has been. And let me tell you, I'm so glad you brought this one up, because this was one of my most meaningful experiences. Miss Honor, I meet in the psychiatric section of the emergency department at the VA hospital. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's routine for people to come in for medical clearance at the VA hospital. They're getting sober or going back to work, and they just need to be cleared so they can move on to their, like a medical doctor saying they're okay to move on to their next program. So she was young and healthy. Could have been quick. It was the end of my shift. I was just helping my colleague by seeing an extra patient before I was leaving. So she was all clear, all good, and I was turning to leave the room, and I just felt I needed to go back, and it didn't matter if I was staying late. I needed to ask her. She had mentioned she had a trauma, but she was getting herself together. So I turned around, and I just asked her if she had mentioned the trauma, if she wanted to speak about it. I was interested in hearing about what she had been through. And she had disclosed that while she was deployed in the military, not only did her supervising officer assault her, I don't know what language I can use on the air, but sexually assault her, but so did her colleague. And the military handled it terribly. I mean, in addition to these crimes against her body, against her psyche, then they tried to ruin her career. And take her livelihood away from her as well. And she had mentioned this is what she was healing from and trying to get sober, because she couldn't figure out how to be in this world sober anymore.
Right.
And that her pastor had told her she needs to forgive them. And we had a long conversation about forgiveness. And first and foremost, I told her that what was done to her was wrong. But she's right, they were wrong. And that this forgiveness would condone none of that. It would just liberate her by recognizing the brokenness in them. And she had expressed a gratitude. I mean, her shoulders relaxed, and she had mentioned that she hadn't spoken about the whole story before, and that was freeing to her. And it was freeing to her to have this affirmation that they were wrong and that she could heal. And so what was also important to me was, you know, while she's rightly fighting for her own survival, that people like me could, I need to talk about this. I need to amplify this. And the structures that did this to her need to be held accountable. And the rest of us can do that while she's healing.
It was so affirming to read that chapter and then have you basically communicate to her that she could make the choice to begin anew, to start again. And that is a choice.
Yeah.
And that all the judgments of, you know, her peers and everything that the military had done did not have to stop her from making that affirming choice to start again.
Yeah.
That was meaningful for you too, it sounds like.
So meaningful. I mean, honestly, that's the whole reason I wrote the book.
Really?
Just to show that we have agency. I mean, part of our deal, I never romanticize trauma, human suffering, but part of the deal of being alive and a human being on this earth is that challenges will occur, and at each point in time, we have a choice if we will move forward, how we will move forward. I use the metaphor of Kintsukuroi, the Japanese art of remaking pottery. Once it's broken, it's fixed by this amalgam of precious metals so that the cracks are highlighted, and it's thought to be more beautiful after the rebuilding. Not because we pretended like nothing happened. No, it happened. And here's where it happened. And now it's stronger and even more beautiful because it's been rebuilt. And I feel the same about human beings. We can make that choice.
A call here from Luke in Ely. Hi, Luke.
Hello.
Hi. I'm glad you waited. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for taking the call. Never called in before, but I heard the content of the conversation. I just couldn't help myself.
I'm glad.
I lost my siblings and I lost our mother 60 days ago.
Oh.
And it was due to severe alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
And something that we were always appreciative of and something that we really noticed all throughout childhood was that every time medical attention was sought, and there were many times, there was never any shame. There was never any kind of cold readout of consequences in regards to her being a parent or her body deteriorating. It was always a team effort. And we were there for most of it. And I'm sure she experienced something differently in her own private meetings with medical professionals. But in the 12 times that we got to communicate for her, we were always treated like we were part of a team just trying to fix the outcome. But we were never given the question of why aren't you doing more? Why aren't you, you know, helping her through this? And why is she still experiencing these issues? And to her own benefit, I think she benefited from not having shame from the people who were trying to help her. There was plenty of shame from legal entities and other types of professionals that we witnessed, but every doctor, every nurse, every paramedic just showed so much understanding and matter-of-factness about it.
Wow. And I'm sure, Luke, you were braced for some of that, right? I mean,
Yeah, we braced ourselves a few years ago. And that's another thing. I mean, we were always communicated with so clearly by everyone that we encountered.
Mm-hmm.
There was no fantasy of, light at the end of a tunnel if she would only do X, Y, and Z.
Right.
We were always very clearly prepared for it, but there was never any guilt or shame about it, and we were always very appreciative of it.
Thank you. Thanks for calling.
Wow. Yeah, thank you. These calls are giving me so much hope. Thank you.
I'm glad to hear that. It struck me in listening to Luke that the last thing you want, but the thing you fear, is that when you come into that confusing world of, you know, a hospital or a medical system, that the people that are there to help are making private judgments about what's happening, right? And to encounter that, encounter an absence of that that's a gift.
Right. It is. That really is. That's huge. Also powerful that they delivered that care with compassion and also honesty, which I think also is a gift.
You have worked in a number of different places. Do you ever think I've committed to giving X amount of years to this kind of work in the ER, but I do see a limit to the time that I can do this the way I do it?
Yes. It is hard. And there is burnout. To continue it full time under these circumstances for decades would be challenging. I mean, I say that I resonate more with my healing mission than any particular title. And which is, as I've discussed, why I wrote the book. So, you know, in the ER, it can help one person at a time, one family at a time, potentially one community at a time. With writing, many more. So I envision an evolution of my path. Not ready to leave clinical medicine yet, certainly, but that part's not over, but the path is evolving.
More writing, I'm sure.
Yeah, I would love to. I really enjoy it. And being part of these discussions with people across the country, throughout the world, it's not depleting. It's rejuvenating while still doing the work. I'm appreciating it.
Call here from Christine in Minneapolis. Hi, Christine.
Hi, Carrie. I'm going to tell you a story about my son. When he was 12 months old, I suspected something was wrong neurologically, and the neurologist sent us straight to the emergency room to get a scan. And there they said, we want to go straight to an MRI. So they admitted us so we could be the first patient in the morning. Well, it was a long wait waiting for the results. And then they put us in a room, and the pediatrician on staff came in to talk to us with her resident. And the resident was holding back tears. And the pediatrician told us they found a large mass in his brain.
Oh,
and
frightening.
It was most likely cancer. And then there was a knock on the door, and it was the anesthesiologist. She came in to talk to us personally and asked if she could pray with us. We all cried. And I thought, these people just met my son, met us. And they care so deeply that I knew we were in the right place. And then we didn't leave the hospital for 18 days. And we followed from the neurosurgeon to the neuro-onc team to the nurses. They were just wonderful. And all through his treatment. And he's almost 7 now, and he's doing great. So, yeah.
Wow. What hospital was that, Christine?
It was Lucile Packard Children's Hospital at Stanford in California.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, that is exceptional.
Yeah, and the neuro-onc fellow, I have his cell phone number, so I could text him. Because at home, my son was sick all the time, and I could text him if something was really severe. He'd have someone call me immediately or give me advice. And now he's at Seattle Children's, and we're still in touch. I send him updates. And I mean, we're just exceptional team. I have nothing bad to say. It was just, I felt, it was just wonderful, wonderful.
I'm
so
glad you called.
I mean, dealing with your baby, I mean, it's terrifying.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That is wonderful. My gosh.
Dr. Harper, you know, we have not mentioned what healthcare professionals have been enduring. How much work have you been doing in the midst of this pandemic? I didn't know if you had taken some time off to finish the writing and then start talking about the book.
Now I practice clinically in New Jersey, so there's been a lull in terms of severity of illness.
Right.
We're seeing an uptick of people coming in with coronavirus, but the severity is not as high right now. But no, through it, I was working full time, and a high toll. And we're seeing what's happening now with in the South and California. So we're bracing because we're all concerned it may happen again, and huge toll. I mean, providers not being able to go home because they're scared of infecting their family. I've treated healthcare providers like from other institutions, and they would present in the ER. And one young man, healthy, fit young man, worked as a technician in a hospital. And the whole time we're speaking, he's apologizing because his phone's ringing off the hook. It's his job telling him to go back. Of course, he can't go back because he was just in the intensive care unit, got sicker at home, and now I have to readmit him to the hospital. And so he can't go back to work. But he said they know that he's sick and his whole department is sick. Mm. They don't have enough staff.
Wow.
So he needs to work anyway. I mean, these were the conditions. So now that there's a lull, we're all bracing. for what might happen later this summer or this fall, this winter.
What do you think, what kind of a reckoning do you think this pandemic has brought to, realizations mm-hmm. too, for the people who do the kind of work that you do? I felt like in the lives of people in medicine, there's a before and an after of this mm-hmm. pandemic. And what do you think that realization looks like?
Oh, where to begin with that? But that there has to be a recognition that healthcare providers are people too, and deserve dignity and respect, and we need to be healthy so we can take care of the community. We need the proper equipment, proper staffing. This has to do, you know, as we touched upon earlier, with larger issues in healthcare, where it's seen as a business that makes profit. That can't be the model if it's going to work. So this is going to require large-scale change institutionally within each hospital, but then in the nation.
We'll be having a lot of policy conversations about that,
yeah.
but it's good to have your insight on this. Dr. Harper, mm-hmm. I so appreciate the conversation this morning. Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you.
Me too. It was a pleasure being here with you and your wonderful guest, caller.
There goes one more mistake. Do I bore you with my problem?
The memoir is called The Beauty in Breaking, Dr. Michelle Harper.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!